Hi, this is Thomas Fogelman. You're listening to Mac Edition Radio.
This is Harris Fogel at Photoshop World in Las Vegas. I'm with Jack Dugan, the president of Dugan Ateliers. How are you doing, Jack?
Pretty good, thanks.
Your specialty is digital fine art printing. And in fact, you have a long history in digital fine art printing. So let's start a little bit in the past about how you got involved with printing and where that led you.
I actually have been doing fine art printing as a serigrapher for probably over 20 plus years or so, more than I want to remember. I had been doing serigraphy using a technique for multiple tonal separations of photographs, the technique I had learned from a fellow up in San Francisco. It was incredibly labor and materials intensive as silkscreen, and it's also very toxic. I had been looking around for a solution to this particular problem, and computers, this is back in 1988, and computers were just sort of coming into their own, and there were a lot of programs that were being written, but there really wasn't anything in printing that I had discovered. Until one day, I had gone into a little studio in Westwood, California, a place called Jet Graphics, which was actually set up by the graduate design department at UCLA under Mitsu Kataoka, who I actually was a TA for 3 years. And he had set up this studio in Westwood using a printer that he had brought over from Japan and a scanning system, which was a large Fujix printer. And it was a huge drum printer. And they had this scanning station, which was an entire clean room for scanning transparencies. And they were using it to print things like backdrops for movies or huge posters. And it was printing on a very, very low quality paper. It's almost like newsprint. The resolution of the detail was almost like golf ball sized dots. It was just not in the category of fine art at all. And I knew that I could not think of any of the artists that I was printing for that would care to use this particular technology. But it was the first time that I'd seen anything ever taken from a photograph and taken straight to an output, which was printing it. So as I was leaving, John Bellotta, who was a graduate student at UCLA at that time and who was actually running the studio for Mitz Kataoka, took me into his office and took out this photograph of this woman in a wedding dress holding a bouquet of flowers. And he said, "You might want to check this out." And I said, "John, I already know about photography. I'm not doing photographic prints for people." He said, "No, this is not a photograph. This is a print. This is an inkjet print made by a printer called an Iris printer." On the back of it was the information for the guy who sold the Iris printer by the name of Steve Bolter. So I took the photograph with me, still thinking of it as a photograph, and I called up this guy, Steve Bolter, and I told him, "You know, I'm a fine art printmaker. I do serigraphs. I've got two studios doing serigraphs. I'm really interested in looking some way to get out of this serigraphic silkscreen way of printing and into printing digitally." And I saw this image over at Jet Graphics that John Bellotta showed me, and I decided to give you a call. And he said, "Well, look, I'm really interested in getting fine art usage applications for the Iris printer. I'd love to come over and meet you." So he came over to my studio, my serigraphy studio, silkscreen studio, and he saw what I did and then took me to Manhattan Beach, where there was an Iris 3047 printer, which was this 35 by 47 inch capability printer, which is a drum that would take a sheet of paper that size. And it was in the garage of this guy, Graham Nash. And I went, "Graham Nash, you mean like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young Graham Nash?" He said, "Yep, same guy. You know, he's a photographer." I said, "No, I didn't know that." He said, "Well, yeah, he's a photographer. He's been taking photographs all his life, ever since he was a little kid. And he is got this show, this traveling show offer, to do these really large photographs of his black and white prints that would travel around the country." All right, so the printer was in this garage, which had an apartment over it, which, coincidentally, Steve was actually staying in at the time, Steve Bolter. And he introduced me to a guy who was working on this printer in the garage by the name of David Koons. Now, David Koons is this incredible color scientist who, at that time, was working for Disney. Disney had purchased a smaller version of the Iris printer from Steve Bolter, and David was the one who was using it to create replications of watercolor backgrounds that were done by the background artists for all of the different animations. The backgrounds were essential because no one could create a set of cells and test them out unless they had the background there first. So every department had to wait for the department before it to finish with the background so that they could then use it for their particular application and their cells to put in front of it to photograph. It was a very difficult and lengthy process of using these particular backgrounds. So what David did is he would take the original background. It was on this very heavy watercolor paper, Arches watercolor paper, what they call a double elephant watercolor paper. Heavy, heavy stuff. And he scanned it on a scanner that they had there at Disney. And he developed a way of printing on watercolor paper on this small iris printer. So he had developed a way of printing on the actual watercolor paper that the original watercolors had been done on this iris printer. And he wrote the algorithms, wrote the color algorithms, so that it was a perfect match to the watercolors. So in that way, he was able to print a half a dozen of these different watercolors on the iris printer. Each department had their own. It revolutionized the way they were able to do their filming. And as a result, it sort of established the standard that nobody knew about except Dave Koons and Steve Bolter. For some reason, Mac Holbert, who was the road manager for Graham Nash, they were always looking for ways to get Graham's photographs into some printable form. They had transparency scanners that would print it to desktop printers, and of course they just had these pin printers at that time, and it was difficult to do it. They would put them in there. They would make larger photographs of the photograph, and they were always looking for ways to try to do reproductions of Graham's photographs. They were introduced to Steve Bolter, I believe by a guy named Charles Warrenberg, good friend of Graham and Max. Steve introduced them to David Koons. When Graham saw the work that David was doing, he said, you know, this is the most incredible color printer I've ever seen. Can I ask you a question? And he said, what? He said, can you make it black and white? He says, you've got a printer here that'll print 16.3 million colors, and you want me to make it black and white. He says, that's right. All my photographs are black and white. If I want to get something like this, would it be possible to print it in black and white? So David said, give me a week. He went back and wrote this amazing algorithm, which to this day has not been matched in terms of the quality of the black and white conversion of a four-color printer printing just black and white using all four colors. Nothing has matched its neutrality until perhaps just recently. But David wrote the original algorithms for that, and he printed out one of Graham's photographs on this huge sheet of watercolor paper, and Graham said, I'm buying one of these things. Well, at that time, they were $120,000 for an iris printer, and he bought this thing and put it in this garage in this house that he owned in Manhattan Beach, and David would show up every day after work and start printing this show, this traveling show, of these huge 35 by 47 photographs on watercolor paper, on this heavy, heavy watercolor paper. So at that point, that's about the time that I met them. I met David Koons. Steve Bolter introduced me, and I saw this thing, and I went, oh, my Lord, I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was so direct and so perfect, and it would take me 3 to 6 months to get something that wouldn't even look as good with having to pay a crew of people working 12 hours a day, you know, using thousands of dollars worth of materials, incredibly toxic solvents and clean up materials, and this was so pure, and it was water. These dyes were water-based, you know. So I started showing up. My serigraphy business was falling off really badly because the horrible, horrible economy got hit really bad in 88, 89. And, you know, something like 40% of the galleries closed in this country, and I had contracts that were canceling right and left. So I had a lot of time on my hands, and I would come over to watch David make these prints, and I asked him, look, I came from the other side. I said, does this thing do color? You know, and he said, well, yeah, why don't you bring me something? So I had one client that had this piece that he wanted right away. There was no way I could get it to him right away. It takes 3 months to even get close, you know, on a serigraph. And I said, well, let me try it out. I got this original. I had it photographed, got an 8x10 transparency, and gave it to David. He took it to Disney and scanned it, and he put it on this huge 9-inch tape reel. That's all we had. There were no computers. We weren't using computers. There was the iris printer sitting in the middle of the cement floor in this garage. Next to it was a card table. On the card table was this tape reader for these huge 9-inch reels, half-inch tape reels. And he would slide this tape into the tape reader, and it was connected directly to the iris, and we'd use the little LCD on the front of the printer to do everything: density, contrast, hues, drum speed, you know, everything. And we printed this one piece out, and it was unbelievable. It was a combination of gouache and watercolor and pastel done by this Chinese artist, this woman. And I had to say that it was almost better than the original. It had more presence than the original. So I took it to the gallery and showed him this piece. And they said, oh my God, can you do 20 of these for us tomorrow? I said, look, I don't even know if I could do one. I just wanted to show you a technology that I've discovered that is capable of doing something that we've never been able to do before. Well, the gallery sent this piece to China to show the woman to get it approved. She never responded. And they made all these phone calls. Look, we've sent you this piece. What do you want us to do? One day, about a week later, this envelope arrives at the gallery. They open up the envelope, and the piece that we had sent her was torn up into 100 little pieces and stuffed in this envelope. Gallery was flabbergasted. They couldn't imagine what had happened. They kept calling and calling. They got interpreters to call. It took about 2 weeks to finally get a hold of the woman in China. When they got a hold of her, they asked, what happened? Why did you tear this piece into pieces and send it back to us? The interpreter said, she was so mortified that you had sent her back her original. She thought you did not like her original, and she was mortified and embarrassed and tore it up and sent it back to you, thinking she had just sent you back her original.
And then did you continue to work with this iris printer?
Well, yeah. What happened then was I would come every day to work on this iris, and David was able to be there shorter and shorter and shorter amounts of time, because they had just geared up for Beauty and the Beast at Disney, and David was completely preoccupied with a CAD system that he was writing for the creation of the ballroom scene in Beauty and the Beast, for which he won an Academy Award for technical merit for that particular process. So he was gone all the time. In fact, he rented a hotel room in Burbank, because he was there all of the time, and he would just stop coming home. Well, Graham had to have this show. So David had his father, who was a retired engineer, come at night and print some of these pieces for him. And then they moved to Arizona. So David talked to me about, well, I'm not going to have time to print this show. I said, Dave, let me do it. Man, I need money. I've got the time. I really love this thing. I want to know everything about it. He said, all right, I'll see if I can get you some money. So they said, okay, we'll get you $40 a print for printing these things. So when I started printing them, and so I jumped at the chance. I said, all right, this is it. I'm coming here every day. I never went home. I just would continue showing up at this place, work all day, work into the night, creating these things. But one of the biggest problems that we ran into was that me at the time ran into was that these sheets of paper, these were huge 40 by 60 sheets of arches, would cost close to $25 a piece. And we were cutting them down to 35, 47 to fit them on the printer. And the problems with printing on this really heavy paper with all of the lint associated with it, this wasn't what the printer was built to do. It was intended to print on smooth, thin sheets of paper that were for proofs that were eventually going to be thrown away. So I kept adjusting the machine to accommodate these, because we were only getting about one out of every four. The other three were bad. They would spit and have these horrible problems, and we'd have to throw them away. So I started developing these different things. I would move the head away. I would figure out ways to change the gap between the spinning drum and the head, and figured out this thing of putting a vacuum cleaner hose, you know, with a tiny little nozzle on the edge of the head so that it would vacuum the sheet just before it printed, so that it wouldn't get the lint in the nozzles, because these little nozzles were spitting out these you know, these like 10 micron droplets in a hair to a 10 micron opening, you know, is like a tree log or something in front of it, and it completely messes things up. So I eventually developed enough techniques creating these bibs, and Iris would come out and see what we were doing and make these changes on the machines because they saw that people were using them. And so I eventually got the show printed. One day I'm in there working, and Mac Hobart walks in the door, and I didn't know it was Mac Hobart. I had never met him. I had only known Steve Bolter and David Koons. I knew that the house belonged to Graham Nash, but I didn't know anything about Mac. So he walks in the door one day and says, "Who are you?" I said, "What do you mean, who are you? What are you coming in here for?" He says, "Well, I'm going to be living in this house, and I'm going to be setting up a little business using this printer to do Graham's work." And I said, "Well, that's great. I'm Jack Duguid, and I'm a fine art printmaker, and I've been printing all of Graham's work. I'm the one who's been doing it. David's been gone." He says, "Oh, well, that's interesting." I said, "Yeah, well, you guys have been paying me." He said, "Well, we want to set up this business." And I said, "Well, do you want to set up a business that just does Graham's work, or are you going to set up a business that does his work and maybe other people's work?" And he said, "Well, I think we'd like to consider doing other people's work as well. You know, if we're going to make a business of it, I've been wanting to get off the road for a long time. I have a new little baby girl, and my wife, I don't ever see them because I'm always on the road. So I'm getting off the road. We're going to move into this house in front of this garage here, and we're going to set this thing up." And I said, "Well, do you want a fine art print studio, or do you just want a service bureau?" He said, "You know, I think I want a fine art print studio. That's really what all of this is about." And I said, "Well, I'm a fine art printmaker, and I've got 15 to 20 years experience in it. Do you want my help? Do you know anything about setting up a fine art printmaking studio?" He said, "Nope, not a thing." I said, "Well, I'd be happy to help you." So he said, "Great. Well, let's see if we can't get you paid, and I'll talk to Graham and see if it's something he wants to do, and I'll call you back."
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history, which we'll discuss later.
Then what happened?
Well, from that point on, Nash Editions began. We actually developed the name Nash Editions, created a little logo for it. We had the one Iris printer. And then we started accumulating equipment. We didn't have any computers. We got old Mac 2s and Mac 2X. It was just this incredible adventure of setting this thing up. We eventually ended up with two Iris printers. We had, you know, a number of computers sitting around the room. And during this time, David Koons was starting to design and build a huge flatbed scanner. We began going to trade shows. We began going to galleries and museums and schools and trying to educate people about what this new technology was. In the meantime, we were beginning to accumulate a stable of artists that we were printing for. And we were printing for everyone. Anyone who wanted it. I was bringing people that I used to do serigraphs for. One of these people that I had done serigraphs for was a woman by the name of Diane Bartz. Diane Bartz did these huge watercolors. And every year, she would have a show at around Christmas time at her house in Palos Verdes. We just finished a series of these prints for her, probably maybe a dozen prints. She was hanging the show and having a wonderful grand time, and she came in this one day to pick up the last of her prints, and she said, "Jack, I've been hanging these pieces. We're putting the little tags up next to each piece on the wall, and what do I call them?" I said, "Well, they're Iris prints." She says, "Well, I really don't want to call them an iris print. No one knows what an iris is. I don't know. Is there something else we could call them?" I said, "Well, how about inkjet print?" She says, "No, that sounds like I took it to Kinko's." I said, "Well, you know what?" I said, "Most printmaking terminology is either Italian or French or British. I mean, the language of the old printmakers from the old analog printmaking, silkscreening and stone lithography and woodblock and collagraph. All of these come from different terminologies created over the centuries." I said, "So I speak French. I lived in France for a couple of years." And I said, Let me do a little research on this over the weekend, and I'll let you know on Monday." This is Friday. She said, "Great." So I went home, and I started thinking about what I could possibly call these that would not necessarily have to do with just this particular printer or this particular technology. It seemed to me that this was the first time I'd seen anything like this. It was the most spectacular thing I'd ever seen, and other people had to be reacting to it in the same way, and it seemed to me that this was going to be a technology that was going to be the next printing. And so I thought, the technology is going to change, the printers are going to change, the people who design them, the science behind them, all of that's going to change. So I had to think of something that would not change. What one element would never change, no matter what the technology, no matter what the printer, no matter what the ink? And I thought, well, essentially in printing, there's just one thing that occurs in printing. You have ink in some form, pigment, dye, color of some form, and you have the paper that it's supposed to go onto. Now, the manner in which the ink is transferred to the paper can only be transferred in one way. It has to pass through a nozzle. No matter what the technology is, no matter what the type of nozzle it is, it will have to have a nozzle. That's the transfer device. So I looked up the word for nozzle in French. And the word for nozzle in French is gicleur, G-I-C-L-E-U-R. The thing that a nozzle does is to spray. The French verb for to spray is gicler, G-I-C-L-E-R. But in the grammar of French, that which is sprayed, the direct object, that which is sprayed by the nozzle, is a gicler, G-I-C-L-E-E, with an accent, rising accent on the first E. Gicler. God, I thought it was phenomenal. I thought, geez, that just rolls off the tongue. It's just like, God, that is sexy. That is like, that's romantic. Gicler, you know? And I thought, oh, I didn't look any further. So Monday morning comes, and I bring all this documentation in of, you know, the etiology of the word gicler. And I tell her I've come up with a word, and I explained everything that I had just explained to you, and she loved it. She just loved it, thought it was just the cat's meow. She labeled all of her prints gicler, and she had this little write-up about what it was, and it was in the newspaper, and so that was that. It just sort of went on, and a month or so later, a woman came in who wanted to have her photographs printed, and she was this big Beverly Hills publicist, and she had rented a gallery space that she had set up for all of her, the display of all her work, and I printed all of her pieces for her, and she asked the same question, and what do we call these? And I said, well, I've come up with this word gicler, which seems to be received really well by a number of artists that I've been talking to who are using it. She said, gicler, oh my gosh, that is beautiful. What is that? Where did you get that word? So I explained the whole thing to her, and she did this huge publicity thing where she had it written up. It was written up in newspapers. She had it put in magazines. She had these huge plaques built and with it engraved in there about the etiology of the word, the beginnings of the word gicler and what it means, and her work was gicler, and it was revolutionary, and it was unique to her. And from that point on, gicler started being used everywhere. One day, Mac Holbrook came in and said, Jack, we've been talking, Graham and I, about this word gicler. And, you know, Graham is a photographer, and his background is in photography, and the work that we've done before that has been printing has been lithography. So we've decided that we've come up with a word instead of photograph or lithograph. We think these should be called digigraph. I said, well, that's a word that works well. It's apt. It's accurate. He said, and also, it's not going to be the policy of Nash Editions that gicler is used. We would prefer to use digigraph. We're not going to prevent you from talking about gicler or using it yourself, or if other artists wish to use it that we print for, that's their choice. It's just our official position is that it won't be used. So I said, well, fine. Thank you. However, over the years, gicler became something that started appearing everywhere. I looked into the possibility of copywriting gicler or trademarking gicler, and it turned out that because it was a new word, it was a generic word. It'd be sort of like having shoes. You can't copyright shoes. but you can copyright Buster Brown shoes. You can copyright Florsheim shoes. So I just let it go. I figured I had been making a living working and teaching in printmaking for almost 15 years by that point. And this was my contribution. This was my giving back to the lexicon of printmaking terminology. And I was proud to have done it. It was a lot of fun, and I've used it over the years. A lot of people use it over the years. I've traveled all over the world. I've gotten publications from every part of the world. And Giclée is international now. It's everywhere on the planet. So, you know, it has some other meanings in French because they're slang, just like there are other meanings in English for just about any word that you can think of. But it has persisted, and it now stands on its own. It's not looked at it in any kind of a strange light. But fortunately, it was instrumental in bringing digital printmaking to people, to the galleries and to the museums and to collectors. And it became something that became so popular that it was refuted, you know, that people said, well, we're not going to use Giclée. Well, we're going to call them inkjet prints now, you know, or this is an iris print, or this is an Epson print, or this is a pigment print, or that's fine. It's wonderful. Giclée still persists. I've never made any money off of Giclée, so it doesn't really matter. But it's interesting to know how everything has evolved since I was there at the very beginning.
I want to thank Jack Dugan for spending time with us today and shedding some light on the real origins and history of the term Giclée as applied to fine art printing. And where can our listeners find out more information about Dugan Atelier?
Dugan Atelier is my studio that I started about 10 years ago. I stayed with Nash Editions for about 6 years, and then I was able to move back to my own studio where I currently live, and I was able to set up a digital printmaking studio there, fortunately. It's called Dugan Atelier. We do limited edition prints for artists and photographers. I'm in Santa Monica at 2651 Main Street. I also have a website at the old www.dugan, that's DUGANNE.com. And you can reach me there, or jack@dugan.com is my email address.
Well, Jack, thanks a whole lot for spending time with us today, and I want to thank you.
Thank you very much. This has really been a pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
For Mac Edition Radio, this is Harris Volpe. You've been listening to Mac Edition Radio. The contents are copyright 2006 and cannot be reproduced without written consent.